Audiobook of the extracts from Paul and Albert of Reverend G. Vale Owen. First published 1924 and still available through Greater World Spiritualist Association for Car. 2 English Bonds. Summary on of chief characters. Paul, a doctor of medicine, dies suddenly one day on returning from his round of visits, and finds himself lying on the floor of a hut in the gloomy borderland of the afterlife, a neutral land, between the region of gloom and that of twilight. His shrunken body, ragged clothes and clouded mind reveal the sordid soul he so cleverly concealed while on earth. He is met by Albert and Monica, two of his victims, and by me, Blesscom, a vicious associate of former days. With them is Sister, from a higher sphere, who has charge of Albert and Monica. She explains to Paul that his future relationship with them, and theirs with him, will largely determine their destinies. He is committed to Albert's care, but no sooner do they begin their journey than he rebels against the guardianship of the man he has wronged. In a fit of frenzy he leaves the road they are treading, and plunges defiantly into the darkness. After a mad career through the horrible life of the hells he returns, weary and broken, to the hut where Albert awaits him. Miss Blesscom, while on earth, had kept a gambling club at her chateau in France, having squandered her father's fortune left to her at his death. She had never married, preferring her free life of vice and swindling, gambling, blackmail and bribes for various shameful services had been her means of livelihood. The doctor was always a welcome guest in her circle. On their first meeting in the borderland he shrinks from her, because the inner woman is revealed by her aspect. But after his mad revolt he finds himself in the neighborhood of her chateau, where, amongst her coterie, she is called Countess. She welcomes him, and he joins her circle of friends. The reasons why she has assumed the title of Countess are given by Sister, where other affectations of the mock genteel order, amongst the members of that community, are also explained. Monica, during her earth life, was lured into vice by the doctor and had been in the darkness since her passing over. At first her agony was sharp, but that soon passed into a state of continuous sadness and remorse which, in its turn, blossomed into repentance. Brought by the Bright Ones into contact with Albert, their reckoning with Paul, the doctor, begins at their entrance into his hut. She follows Paul into the wilderness, whither he plunges headlong in his defiance. She meets him again outside the cave, where he has been flung after torture, and tries to lead him back to Albert. Paul turns upon her in a fury and tries to fell her to the ground, but he is forcibly restrained by Sister, who takes Monica away, and leaves him to his self-inflicted fate. She and Sister take charge of the poor pantomime, the girl whom Paul brutally kicked insensible. Albert, during his earth life, sustained a bad accident to his face, and was attended by the doctor. This doctor, Paul, was secretly intriguing with Albert's wife, and saw an opportunity to lessen her esteem for her husband. Accordingly, he purposely bungled the treatment of the case, with the result that his patient became permanently disfigured. Paul, therefore, is terrified when he meets his victim in the borderland. Finding himself in Albert's charge, he defies him, breaks away, and wanders through the dark hells. Albert patiently waits until Paul returns, when he takes him to a church near the hut, in which those of their condition may find rest and guidance. There they meet a missioner, a visitor from a higher sphere beyond the hills, who points out the progress they have both made, and blesses them for their future work. On leaving the church, in a short time they arrive at the road where they had parted company earlier in the narrative. Bitter experience has taught Paul humility. He now puts himself under Albert's guidance. So instead of turning aside, he accompanies Albert along the broad highway that leads to the pass between the hills. Sister, born a Breton on earth, has charge of several rest houses in the borderland. She visits Paul, after his passing over from earth into this gloomy region, and consigns him to Albert's care. During Paul's mad rebellion she rescues Monica from his fury, and takes charge of the poor girl he had ill-fated at me. Blesscom's chateau. When Paul and Albert have met again and once more begun their journey toward the land of the dawning, Sister meets them as they sit resting by the roadside. She opens their eyes to the improvement in their appearance, the result of endurance and repentance, and guides them into the land of the dawning. There Paul and Albert are reunited to their wives in happy reconciliation. There is also a partly German translation of this book online at galactic.no. Introduction. The Paul and Albert inspirational script was received by Mr. Vale Owen from the band of spirit communicators who had previously contributed the first three volumes of The Life Beyond the Veil, but in this instance Sister, in quotes, was leader. The intermediary between the band and the recipient of the narrative was Kathleen, through whom, therefore, the actual form of the narrative came. Sister, born a Breton on Earth, has charge of several rest houses in the borderland. She visits Paul, after his passing over from Earth into this gloomy region, and consigns him to Albert's care. Kathleen in Earth life was a seamstress who lived in Anfield, Liverpool, and passed over in about the year 1893, at the age of 28. Paul and Albert is complete in itself, and in character differs greatly from the rest of the Vale Owen script. Although the names of the people are fictitious, the narrative itself is true, that is, as true as is possible when giving a picture of the other life in language of Earth. The communicators, Kathleen explains, have transmitted this story with deliberation and purpose. Those who lead dainty and delicate lives, regardless of their obligations to less fortunate people, will read in the pages following what kind of life awaits them soon. And if its portrayal, she says, toned down though it be, is not sufficient to deter these selfish ones, they would not be bettered were the wickedness and horror more fully described. The mission, then, of these communicators seems to be to underline with no uncertain hand the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Reading this account of Paul's wanderings through the hells reminds one forcibly of Dante's Inferno, since the same atmosphere of terror surrounds both. Their differences, however, are fundamental. Readers of the Divine Comedy will remember that above the entrance to Inferno the great poet reads the sentence, "All hope abandon, ye who enter here." That is its keynote. In Paul and Albert, however, there is no room for such despair. Hope is possible even for those in the lowest hells. No soul is utterly lost, nor is there any wastage in the great economy of the Creator. Another Paul wrote, centuries ago, "If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as through fire." The burning, then, is remedial, a purifying, and hell is a purgatorio. The torment there is self-inflicted, and the essential folly of wickedness emerges unmistakably. Paul's anguish is the natural result of his actions during his life on earth. Having entered the next stage of existence, a continuation of this, he still bears on his lack the burden of a selfish life. He lives the, as are, under the same laws, urged by the same motives. The only difference is that the crust of pretense, so carefully built around himself on earth, is stripped off him at a stroke. It follows that unseen influences, in obedience to those laws, impinge upon his naked soul with greater and more terrible intensity. At every step in his descent he may turn back if he will. Yet, while fearing the threat of anguish, he embraces it, and, although at first the stench of hell nauseates him, he inures himself to its horror. Each moment is a crisis, each action the result of free choice. Yet at every fresh step he degrades himself, sinking lower and lower, till the evil within him is exhausted. Then he realizes that wickedness is another name or folly. It will be interesting to the reader to notice how punishment fits the crime in the hereafter. Paul's chief fault, during his life on earth, was selfishness, which often took the forms of avarice and cruelty. After he has entered the afterlife, he finds that all his gains, so carefully hoarded, are gone, his clothing is merely rags, and his body is shrunken like that of a miser. Drawn by an unresisted attraction, he joins different communities, each made up of people as selfish and false as himself, till he reaches the point when he despises and fears them. Before that crisis comes upon him, his sensuous nature also is allowed full play. He discovers, however, that far from satisfying his desires, he is so tormented by them, that he sickens of the condition into which they have driven him. Hypocrisy was another of his weaknesses. So, we find him at the old chateau, strutting and preening himself like a gallant of old, one of many poses. Yet all the while he knows how trivial is this finicking pretense. Also, an important point, he is uncomfortably aware that the others know it too. It is easy for a hypocrite to gain some satisfaction from his acting among honest people, who expect honesty from him, and seem to get it. No satisfaction, however, can be gained when those whom he meets are laughing up their sleeves, because, being students of hypocrisy themselves, they see through the farce, and are positive they can do it much better. Thus each flame of Paul's fire of wickedness is damped out, leaving nothing but ashes. Full realization is the turning point of his career. He begins to return towards the light he left so precipitately. But, swift as the descent of a human soul can be, the reascent is always slow and arduous. And Paul is but the wreck of his former self. Weary and broken, shorn of self-respect, and of respect for others, he faces the greatest crisis of all his experience. Hope comes to him at last. Certain words, forgotten in the excitement of his frenzy, come to the forefront of his memory and help him now. Albert and sister, who had spoken them, still wait for him with inexhaustible patience and love. Resolution surges within him. He will get back, back to the friends he had foolishly spurned. He scales the ascent, so steep and heartbreaking. By dint of that innate determination he had ill-used hitherto, he fights his way upward to the borderland, from whence he had wandered. There Albert at once takes him in charge, and they two together, gaining in strength and joy with every step, pursue a nobler path, which leads to the land of the dawning. The above is only a cursory summary of a remarkable narrative, which must be read carefully, and not too quickly, to make a just impression of the great theme it contains. The word pictures will be found very vivid, and its atmosphere pronounced. Editor. How the messages were received. Mr. Vale Owen gave a description, published in a previous volume, The Outlands of Heaven, of how it came about that he acted as amanuensis, and the way in which the script came through his mentality. His account is as follows. There is an opinion abroad that the clergy are very credulous beings. But our training in the exercise of the critical faculty places us among the most hard to convince when any new truth is in question. It took a quarter of a century to convince me 10 years that spirit communication was a fact, and 15 that the fact was legitimate and good. From the moment I had taken this decision, the answer began to appear. First my wife developed the power of automatic writing. Then through her I received requests that I would sit quietly, pencil in hand, and take down any thoughts which seemed to come into my mind projected by some external personality and not consequent on the exercise of my own mentality. Reluctance lasted a long time, but at last I felt that friends were at hand who wished very earnestly to speak with me. They did not override or compel my will in any way that would have settled the matter at once, so far as I was concerned, but their wishes were made ever more plain. I felt at last that I ought to give them an opportunity, for I was impressed with the feeling that the influence was a good one, so, at last, very doubtfully, I decided to sit in my cassock in the vestry after evensong. The first 4 or 5 messages wandered aimlessly from one subject to another. But gradually the sentences began to take consecutive form, and at last I got some which were understandable. From that time, development kept pace with practice. When the whole series of messages was finished, I reckoned up and found that the speed had been maintained at an average of 24 words a minute. On 2 occasions only had I any idea what subject was to be treated. That was when the message had obviously been left uncompleted. At other times I had fully expected a certain subject to be taken, but on taking up my pencil the stream of thought went off in an altogether different direction. The effect of what, perhaps, we might term the more mechanical operations, as these impinge upon the organism of the human brain, the transmitters themselves describe in some detail. Vibrations, initiated by them and projected through the veil, find their target in the mentality of the human instrument and are reproduced, on this side in what is, in effect, a kind of inner clairvoyance and clairaudience. That is, he sees these scenes in his imagination as he, by a similar process, is able to visualize his garden or house, or other well-known face, when at a distance. The words of the messages seem to travel on a celestial mundane telephonic current. He can hear them interiorly in much the same manner as he is able to hum over a well-remembered tune, or to reproduce speech he has heard with all its inflections and cadences, pathetic or uplifting, all this interiorly, and without himself uttering a sound. In addition, however, there is a deeper content to the operation. It is that effect upon the human instrument produced by the more or less intimate contact of spirit with spirit. This is actual spiritual communion, and is recognized in the Creed of Christendom in the article The Communion of Saints. So intimate and so perfect must be the sympathy, aim and affection existing between transmitter and receiver, that whenever any thought comes through which seems to be at variance with what is true, immediately a shock is felt, and the instrument faces about, as it were, with a query in his mind, which on the part of the communicator is as immediately observed and noted. The transmitters of Paul and Albert were a band of spirit communicators, including Kathleen, and led by Sister, and the human instrument, mentioned above, was the receiver, Mr. Vale Owen. In the following, P means side number. P6 means, for example, then page 6. Chapter 1. The reckoning begins. Tuesday, January 14th, 1919, 5.50 to 6.52 p.m. Not long ago a man came over here who had been a doctor of medicine in the earth life. He had a London practice, and died suddenly after going his daily round of visits. He had a rather nice house and a comfortable income, which had lately been increasing quickly, and he was therefore much surprised on awaking to find himself in a miserable slash dismal room, unlighted and not over clean, lying on the floor in a corner. He sat up and looked about him, and the first thing which came into his mind, when he had once realized that he was not asleep and dreaming, was, kidnapped. But why? He sat there for a long time trying to think the matter out, and so much was he taken up with his surroundings that it was only after a considerable period, that he thought of looking at himself. Then he was shocked to find that he was attired in a suit of dirty colored calico, printed cotton fabric, much shrunken and ragged. The coat was baggy and shapeless, and much too large for him, and the trousers reached only to his knees where they ended in tatters. He also observed that, whereas he had been a finely made man with stalwart limbs, now his arms and legs were shrunken and bony, and his body, he realized, was in like condition, and that, altogether, he was smaller than he had been. He sat there wondering how this had come about and almost began to doubt his own identity. This he was unable to do, however, for he knew he was himself and no other. He also knew he had been unconscious, but was now awake and alert enough. So he tried to remember what had happened before he lost consciousness. Still there was nothing in his recollections to account for his present condition. The last thing he remembered was his arrival home and asking his wife what there was for dinner. Then he went to have a wash and to change his coat. Here his memories were suddenly cut short and he remembered nothing further. At that moment the door opened and a woman entered. She was dressed in a garment of the same colorless hue as his own, an armless tunic reaching to the knees. She went to another corner and lay down without noticing him in the least. Then another woman and a man entered and, behind them, a third woman came. They spoke neither to him nor to each other, but all, except the last to enter, lay down as if they were very weary, and had only one object in view, and that was to go to sleep, not so much to rest their bodies as to sink into mental oblivion. For their faces were haggard and their eyes were but the windows of tortured souls. The one-time doctor sat with his back against the angle and gazed on them in surprise and, presently, in horror. For the longer he looked at them the more hideous and malevolent did their faces, and even their attitudes, appear. There was, in some indefinable way, a sense, an atmosphere, of wickedness, hate and agony in the room, and this had become intensified as each had entered, so that it had now become intolerable. But the strange thing about this feeling was that the wickedness and malevolence seemed to be not so much theirs as his own, reflected back to him. So he resolved to go outside and see if it was any better there. But when he tried to rise, he found himself so weak as to be quite unable to do so. He sat there gazing at his companions, therefore, and by, he began to realize that none of them was asleep. As they lay there on the ground, they were all looking at him, and, even in that gloomy semi-darkness, he could see their eyes as if they were lighted from behind with an inner flame, incandescent. Then gradually he became more and more afraid until he could scarce keep his limbs from shaking with terror. But he strove to do this, for he felt that if he moved they would all spring at him. This effort, too, was torture, but better, he told himself, than even being addressed by such hideous, bestial people as these seemed to his disturbed mind to be. Then there came over him once again the remembrance of the scene he had just left. It could not have been more than a couple of hours or so since he was in his own comfortable, well-warmed and well-furnished home, just about to sit down to a good meal after a long day's work. It seemed to him actually about 10 minutes. He had been figuring out what he had made in that day, as he motored home in his comfortable car with his chauffeur in front. He had been idly gazing at the chauffeur's back, and the quaint thought had come into his mind that, if the man had about, say, 30 shillings in his pocket, and his watch had cost £3, and his underclothes, say, £2, the uniform had cost about £5.10 complete, well, he had made just about 1 3/8 of what would buy the man as he sat there. And it had not been an extra good day, so far as remuneration went. Now I tell you this because it was typical of the man. Kind actions he had done now and again. But his real object in life was not a high one, and certainly not altruistic. After that he remembered his arrival home, and then all was blank. And here he was, sure enough. But how had he come here? Not of his own will, he was certain. Then another thought flashed upon him. Mad. Yet he had never shown any signs of madness that he was aware of, nor was insanity in his family. I have said that he dreaded his companions. But so great was his terror at the uneasy silence and their continued motionless staring at him that, at last, against his will, he suddenly cried out, "Why don't you speak, some of you? Why do you lie glaring at me like that? Is this your home, and, if so, how do I come to be in it?" Then the three women looked at the other man, and he rose and went and stood a few feet away from the doctor and said, "There's no hurry, my friend, plenty of time for everything here," and he laughed in a mirthless way. Then he continued, waving his hand towards his companions, "We have come together here, but this is not our home. This is your home. Ours is not far away. But we were informed of your arrival and were sent to greet you. As I said before, here is plenty of time for everything, and, therefore, we have not forced the pace." Then ensued this conversation between the two men, "But this is not my home." "Oh, is that so? And which is your home, if this is not it?" The doctor gave the address. "Oh, I see. So that's your home." "Yes, so it is. That's where I remember coming to consult you once. I was a patient of yours. Just have a good look at me. No? Well. Well, your memory seems to have failed you somewhat. That's too bad. I thought you would have a niche in your memory for an old friend." Suddenly the doctor uttered a loud shriek of agony. The nose of the man had been broken and badly set, and he recollected the case at once. Then the other continued, "Ah, I see you have a glimmering of my identity, at any rate. You remember this nose, don't you? That is why I was informed of our coming. Now, I must explain that when this man had sustained a bad accident, he had been attended by this same doctor and had, later on, come to his residence for further treatment. When the bandages were at length removed, however, it was found that the nose was shapeless, and his face disfigured for life. He did not suspect then that it was intentional, but afterwards found that the doctor had been carrying on an intrigue with his wife and, in order to lessen her esteem for her husband, had adopted these means. Wednesday, January 15, 1919, 5.35 to 6.50 p.m. So the doctor was very much afraid, and cowered back in his corner. But the other said, "I see you remember me now. Well, you will also realize that you are no longer in a position to do to others as you did to me. You have quitted your body and, with it, your home and all that helped to make life comfortable for you. Now you have to start again, as I had to do when I came here, and you seem to have about as much chance of making it bearable as I had, less, I should judge. But where am I? Where is it you live? Oh, a little way down the street. I'm going to take you there shortly. But first these ladies, he added with a sneer, wish to renew your acquaintance or, in other words, they have been ordered to do so. We will not go into all the sordid dealings which were brought back to his memory as he recognized two of them. Once was a young woman whom he had lured into vice, and then cast aside. She had lingered a few years making a living as he had first taught her to do, and then had passed on after a very painful illness in an isolation hospital. Another was also young, but of a different aspect. She was not coarse in feature, nor so ill-clad, and her form was even comely. She stood in the background and did not take part in the proceedings. It was she who had entered the room last and alone, and, indeed, the others seemed scarcely aware of her presence. P6 The third woman was past middle age. Her hair was nearly white, her face hard and fierce. She came to him and bent over him, glaring into his eyes in silence. Then he murmured, "Madame Blescombe." At this she smiled grimly, and answered, "Oui. I am glad Monsieur knows me again. We shall now renew our good comradeship. Many an hour we shall gill with reminiscences of the old days at the chateau, eh, Monsieur?" She had kept a gambling club at her chateau in France, having squandered her father's fortune left to her at his death. She had never married, having preferred her free life of vice and swindling. Gambling, blackmail, bribes for various shameful services had been her means of livelihood. The doctor was not unknown to her circle, and always a welcome guest. Now he shrank from her for, in a flash, the inner woman was revealed and somewhat of the fate to which her former manner of life had brought her. For that he cared but little. What troubled him was the fact that it revealed at the same time the probable destiny in store for himself. After a while the man spoke again. "Now," he said, "get up and follow me. Your first destination is my own desirable residence." And when the wretched man hesitated to rise, being now almost paralyzed by terror, he added more sharply, "Look here, doctor, we may as well understand one another at once and finally. Listen. I have been through hell. I will not describe my experiences to you, you will be able to sample them in your own person shortly. Suffice it to say that there were extenuating circumstances in my case which will not be found in your own, poor devil. These have been pointed out to me, and I have had sense enough to take advantage of them. The result is a rapidity of transit through those dark halls and gloomy caverns which otherwise would have been much prolonged." Here he paused a moment, as if memory paralyzed utterance, and then continued in a subdued tone. It was as if he had caught the faint sound of a distant voice of admonition and warning, "I have come through it more quickly than many do, but I am only through the very worst of it. You have but to look at me to see I am still in hell. I am only not so deep in it as I was. Indeed, I have seen a faint gleam of light, and it has helped. Oh, there you are, my good friend. I thought I heard you whisper to me just now. Was that so?" He had caught sight of the young girl who had entered last. Kathleen speaks of her as sister. She had come forward quietly and stood at his left hand. She answered him, "Yes, I did send you a little word to restrain you. You were forgetting, were you not? Now let me explain the rest to this poor fellow." Then to the doctor she said, "This man has called you doctor. That office is no longer yours, for you have not used it well. As to your medical skill, I will only say that it was not nearly so great as either you or your unfortunate patients considered it to be. For it was based on material science, and even the bodies of your patients are more than mere matter. You took no account of the fact that those bodies were permeated through and through with spirit, which being withdrawn animation ceased. What made the affair so much worse, I still speak in a medical sense, was that your motive in chief was the making of money. The curing of your patient was not the aim, but only a name. It was not the principal aim you had in view. It took a subordinate place. You would not have admitted this, even to yourself. You would have been shocked at the suggestion,